Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independence coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya, on the lands of Ngarrindjina. Our team pays our deepest respect to elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show,
that is opening up the possibility for the police to use move-on powers against protesters. And I think that's really problematic because it really places the police in the position, in the moment, of being able to make a decision about who's entitled to exercise their right to peaceful assembly.
In the wake of a recent neo-Nazi demonstration, New South Wales Premier Chris Minns has indicated new laws to restrict protesting, allowing New South Wales police more power. But the announcement leaves advocates concerned. Also, it's been a year since the federal government released its multicultural framework review. So what's changed and what's yet to be done? And later,
the themes that I look at in my practice are deeply human. Things like regret or vain hope or disconnection between family members or things like this that are really essential to our experience.
That's Ida Sophia, 2023's Ramsey Art Prize winner. She shares more on how the award influenced her work and what it means to connect with Australian audiences and those abroad through art. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, recent reports indicate adults and children as young as 10 in the Northern Territory could be left without legal representation when charged with a crime, unless they are already in custody. This comes as Legal Aid NT has been forced to cut services to address end-of-year funding shortfalls, according to the ABC, a situation leaving advocates outraged, with one organisation terming it a betrayal of their communities. I spoke with Tabitha Lean, organising member with the National Network of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls, to hear more on their reaction and what this could mean for a person's right to a fair trial and navigation of the legal system.
This is not just a funding crisis. It's a profound betrayal of communities who are already being relentlessly over-surveilled, over-policed, mass-incarcerated in some of the harshest prison conditions that us as a national network have seen across this country. And it's not being seen in a vacuum. Like, it's landing in the middle of this law and order crisis that's been whipped up by the Finocchiaro government, who are refusing to invest in communities and instead funneling every political instinct into their punishment, policing and imprisonment. And what this will do is now leave adults and children unable to get representation in court and have to effectively represent themselves. And that will leave children as young as 10 without legal representation.
And that's considered as part of a human right.
We see it as a basic legal principle that you have the right to representation in the legal system. When you go to court, these are foreign systems, and some people who go into court, English is their second or third language. And as it is, being in the legal system, it's a very foreign type of system to come up against. It can be quite scary navigating that language, that sort of place. This is why we have lawyers, and people have the right to access legal support, and we cannot leave people without that.
Further to that, I'm aware that the CLP government produced 5 pieces of tough on crime legislation last year. How have these played out on the ground, and what impact do you think these have had on the justice system and greater need for legal representation?
Well, what it means is that we've got more people coming before the criminal legal system. As a national network, we recently visited the Northern Territory and met with a lot of women who have been criminalised, and they are facing more and more people being swept up off the streets into prison. If you are going to criminalise more people, you have to resource the services that safeguard their rights. The government is sweeping up people off the street. They're expanding police power. They're toughening bail laws. And when they lowered the age back to 10, they cannot act shocked when courts and legal services can't cope. And what it means for people on the streets is they are being surveilled. You only have to walk through the city centre to see, with the private security guard descending upon people who might even look slightly like they're going to create a noise.
The CLP lowered the age of criminal responsibility back to 10 from 12. Reforms have also decreased or scrapped the principle of prison being a last resort for children. Many as young as 10 charged with a crime could face detention rather with no legal representation. Why is this so detrimental in formative years?
I think you only have to think about the children in your own family and imagine them, one, facing court on their own without legal representation, or two, thinking of them in a cage, strip searching a child, having adults strip that child naked before them. We should not be having children in prison. This will have an enormous impact on children if they're forced to represent themselves or they don't have support in court. We'd really love to see the Northern Territory government invest in children, keep children in their classrooms, keep children in their communities, keep them in their bedrooms.
There have been major criticisms around the Northern Territory's tougher laws or more authoritarian stance and the shift away from third sector society. What could this mean for the future and in terms of Australia's culture?
I think we're seeing right across the country an increase in punitive law and order policies. I think we've seen that in the Northern Territory with repealing the laws that sort of where they've reduced the age of criminal responsibility back to 10, wanting to reintroduce spit hoods into the Northern Territory, about the punitive bail laws. We've seen it in Queensland with the adult time, adult crime. We've seen it in Victoria where they're looking to introduce serious crime, adult time. We've seen it in South Australia with the latest youth legislation. What we're seeing across the country is governments unable to think outside the cage. They're responding in a very reactive way in increasing and expanding police powers, increasing and expanding the prison, rather than investing in our communities.
What are you calling for in relation to supporting legal services?
Look, right now in the Northern Territory, the National Network has called for immediate funding to Legal Aid NT and NAJA to meet current demand. We've called for a reversal of the punitive bail and sentencing laws which are driving the current caseloads. We'd love to see them raise the age of criminal responsibilities, stop charging children with crime. We want to see them invest in prevention, not punishment. Invest in the community-led supports, not cages. And stop manufacturing these crises and start listening to the communities. The Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory know what works for their people. They know how to keep their communities safe. They know how to care for their children and their communities. Start listening to the Aboriginal community there. Invest in them. Invest in what they're doing there. They have the solutions. If these punitive, tough on crime laws really worked and really created safety, the Northern Territory would be the safest place in the country, but it's not. Punitive laws increase incarceration, not safety. True safety comes from support, not punishment.
Tabitha Lean, organising member with the National Network of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls, speaking with me. The Wire contacted the Northern Territory Government for comment. NT's Attorney General, Marie-Claire Boothby, will meet with Legal Aid NT this week and says Legal Aid NT has received significant support from the Territory. Also saying, my expectation is that Legal Aid NT, NAJA and the broader profession work together to ensure Territorians can access legal assistance and victims receive faster justice. For the full statement, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
It's been a year since the Multicultural Framework Review was published by the federal government, examining the state of Australian multiculturalism. While there are some positive outcomes over the last 12 months, multiculturalism still faces a lot of challenges so far. An event in Sydney called Unfinished Business, organised by Polar and Connect, has assessed the outcomes of the review. And The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked their CEO, Eva Hussein, if there are any improvements from the review.
Let me just start with giving your listeners Just a little bit of background about what the Multicultural Framework Review is. So it was a major review of Australia's multicultural policies and institutions. It was conducted to assess how well they support our increasing diverse population. And as an outcome of that, a report called Towards Fairness, a Multicultural Australia for All was produced. And it had 29 different recommendations to the Australian government on, you know, how to improve policies and practices related to multiculturalism. And the focus was on connection, identity and inclusion. And it involved, you know, public consultation, meetings, submissions. I think they've received something like 1,500 submissions from, you know, all peoples of all walks of life. And essentially it identified what Australia, you know, while Australia is a successful multicultural nation, there are persistent challenges, you know, particularly experiences of racism and discrimination. And the other thing that the review discovered is that communities want to be more involved in decision-making process. So when you ask me a question, I guess a good step was to actually ask people what they thought. And then, you know, the framework review is actually a blueprint or a plan that we are to follow. And it is a bit slow in the making. So that is why we organised an event in Sydney to give the government a little bit of a push, but also because it's everybody's business. And, you know, our event was called Unfinished Business because it isn't something we can ever finish. You know, multiculturalism is a journey in Australia, I guess.
So speaking about the event, how is the multicultural community perceiving the framework review so far? What did they say at that event?
It was overall a positive event, but we felt that communities are being a little bit over-consulted and that, you know, the Multicultural Framework Review is a shiny, wonderful document, a great roadmap, but what is actually happening? So there was that kind of feeling of, you know, slight, I would even say disappointment maybe even, because we now have, which is very exciting, we now have a Minister for Multicultural Affairs who's a person we've lived a migration experience. Anne Ali is the minister, the new minister. There's been a new office established for her, which is all great news, but we're kind of waiting to see what happens with that. And in a way, the event was also to empower communities and reclaim this space, meaning that we are taking, you know, matters into our own hands. We're no longer waiting. We're leading the conversation.
So what are the main points where we can say we're progressing according to this review? What are we doing well so far?
So what we are doing well so far is having the conversation, I think. And again, you know, I just go back to the sentiment in the room, which was very optimistic and positive. But yet we also heard, you know, from old hands in this space like me that, you know, we've told you what we think. We've told you what we should do. We are just not waiting for action. And I think it's, you know, this space belongs to us all. So we're looking forward to, you know, all the policies and the framework to be realigned with community expectations, I guess. But it isn't like we can just give it to the government and expect, you know, funding or, you know, action. It is a space that belongs to all of us and we need to act. So I think, you know, some of the initiatives I've already mentioned are positive, where the minister is actually in cabinet. So for the first time ever, we have someone front and centre representing the communities. But I think it's an ongoing journey that we just need to work at together in unison and keep talking about it.
And what about the challenges? What are some of the challenges we're facing?
Look, again, I would say that the biggest challenge is that we've developed together as a community a wonderful document, a great roadmap, but how do we deliver on it is the question. The other questions, you know, that I have is what is working? How can we build on what's working? You know, because sometimes we just reinvent the wheel, I guess. And what happens if the funding doesn't come through? You know, it's a space where our funding's limited. You know, spaces like settlement and refugee settlement feels like it's underfunded. So, you know, can we come up with solutions ourselves as a community? You know, what are models that are sustainable? How can we collaborate and how can we be community-led? So these are just some of the questions we're asking. And, you know, the bold action that we need to take and move beyond the usual narratives where we, you know, keep talking about the issues being consulted. We need to change that conversation quite a bit, I think.
CEO of Polar and Connect, Eva Hossein, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. In the wake of the recent neo-Nazi rally outside the New South Wales Parliament, Premier Chris Minns says it's likely current police powers regarding protests will be tightened. This comes just days after the New South Wales government reintroduced an amendment bill, giving police the power to move on protesters at places of worship. Experts are concerned ushering in anti-protest laws in response to specific events could erode the right to protest. The Wire's George Popple has the story.
Speaking at a press conference on Sunday, Premier Chris Minns claimed he was looking to give police more legislated powers to stop protesters in the wake of the recent neo-Nazi rally outside the New South Wales State Parliament. Luke McNamara is a professor of law at the University of New South Wales. He's sceptical of whether giving police more laws is the right approach.
I'm concerned that yet again we're seeing that the government's response to a controversial event is to propose new laws, new police powers, new offences. It's a cycle we've been stuck in for quite a while now, and I am concerned because I don't think we're taking sufficient time to consider whether the laws that we currently have are adequate, can be deployed differently.
This recent protest has led to discussion regarding how the police interpret existing protest laws and whether definitions of public safety concerns adequately address racist demonstrations.
Some of the things that the police have publicly suggest that they have interpreted the existing law pretty narrowly. So most decisions about whether or not the police decide to oppose a public assembly are based on public safety considerations. Now, the legislation that governs whether an assembly is authorised, the rally, the legislation doesn't specify that public safety is the only consideration. What the common law says on this topic is that if a court is required to make a decision about whether a protest should be authorised or prohibited, it should balance competing interests and rights. So on the one hand, the important right to protest, the right of peaceful assembly, which we all are supposed to enjoy. On the other hand, there are other rights in play. There are the rights of all people to go about their business largely unencumbered by the activities of others. But another balancing consideration, another set of rights that should be, I would argue, part of the mix is the right of individuals and communities not to be subjected to racism via public protest. I hope the police are reconsidering the approach they took to this particular protest. And next time round, they may take into account in a more sophisticated way, a richer sense of public safety that takes into account the harm that can be done by the presence of a neo-Nazi organisation in public, in their uniforms, with their displays, with their chants. All of those things, I think, could be reconceived from the police point of view as risks to public safety, in particular to the safety of members of the Jewish community, and indeed members of a whole range of minority communities who are targeted by the attitudes and views of neo-Nazi organisations.
The Minns government has also recently sought to reintroduce move-on police powers for protests at places of worship, in spite of the New South Wales Supreme Court finding such laws unconstitutional in October. Move-on powers have been in effect for 3 decades. However, experts are concerned recent reforms impede on the right to protest.
It wasn't until the late 1990s that the New South Wales Parliament saw fit to formalise the authority of a police officer to direct a person to move a particular location if they formed the view that the person's presence there was likely to cause harassment or intimidation or disruption to other members of the public. When move-on powers were first introduced in the late 1990s, there was a real concern that they could be used inappropriately to stifle public protest. And so there were specific provisions added to the legislation which made it really clear that the police could not use move-on powers against protesters because that would be a really serious infringement of the right to peaceful assembly under international human rights law. And what we've seen over the last decade is that governments have had a couple of attempts now at eroding that protection, that is, opening up the possibility for the police to use move-on powers against protesters. And I think that's really problematic because it really places the police in the position, in the moment, of being able to make a decision about who's entitled to exercise their right to peaceful assembly. We've already seen a case earlier this year where the Supreme Court of New South Wales ruled that the latest attempt to expand Move On powers was deemed unconstitutional. I would have hoped that the New South Wales government would have taken the lesson there, that this is not an appropriate way to regulate protests. And so I'd be concerned about the suggestion that they're going to have another attempt to make Move On powers more widely available against protesters.
Professor Luke McNamara from the University of New South Wales, speaking with The Wire's George Popple.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
...2023's Ramsey Art Prize winner has spent the past 2 years overseas, mostly Berlin-based. For just 2 weeks, artist Ida Sophia returned home to SA, a place linked to childhood, growing up, and the inspiration of her artworks, which explore religious themes. Her latest exhibit, Limited Terms of Grace, a mix of visual and performative mediums, extend those ideas by drawing from Christian material culture. The Ramsey Art Prize is presented by the South Australian Art Gallery and is awarded every 2 years to Australian artists under 40. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with Miss Sophia about the significance of winning the award, mentoring others, and what it means to connect with Australian audiences and those abroad.
Of course, I was in shock. I was lost for words, but it was a huge honour. I was really pleased that I was able to have this work debuted at the Ramsey Art Prize and for so many people to see it. And it really opened up a lot for me in terms of career moves. I've been offered my first museum invitation from the Sansag Museum of Art and my first survey show at the Ridock Art Gallery in Mount Gambier, which is my hometown. It also enabled me to do some amazing international travel and mentorships with some other artists, so to professionally develop in my career. Yeah, it's been quite extraordinary. It's a very special prize.
As an Australian artist, what has it meant to you to be able to travel and showcase your work in other parts of the world?
I have moved to Berlin since winning the prize, and I work between the two countries, between Australia and Germany and Europe at large. But it's meant that I have been able to carry dialogues that we're having here in the contemporary art scene in Australia, and of course in our social wider dialogue over there, and to see where the links can be made in a global conversation and how I can contribute to them through the artwork that I make. The audience is more similar than you would think. The themes that I look at in my practice are deeply human. Things like regret or vain hope or disconnection between family members or things like this that are really essential to our experience.
So your aesthetic in Limited Terms of Grace, it draws from Christian material culture. Why have you used these themes in your work?
I was brought up in three different denominations of the church, so Uniting, Protestant and Catholic. So it's really where my aesthetic wheelhouse was born, through looking at stained glass and all of the beautiful Baroque, the gold, the silver, the velvets, all of these kinds of materials, to take them and employ their sort of seductive quality. We're really attracted to materials, and it allows us to let our guard down a little bit and approach the work with more openness than we might in other ways. So it's a bit of a tactic that I learned with churches. They're so beautiful, so aesthetically rich. They draw us in and they allow us to go deeper with our emotional investment into what we're looking at.
How has the travel and exposure to overseas culture informed or impacted your perceptions of your art?
I've been able to see the way that artists have worked and considered difficult topics in a way that is so ancient compared to what I've been able to see in Australia. And so that's deeply inspiring. I've seen allegories of penance, for example, portrayed in a church that was built 600 years ago, and still the emotional resonance has deep meaning to me today, as it does for many people.
What does it mean to you when you use art in a way that may be considered extreme, like in I Remember How It Feels to Be Made of Flesh, with the dress with thorns on the inside, and Witness with repetitive baptism?
These are both durational performances, and they're difficult works for sure. The repetitive gesture is endless. It's a temporal loop where we don't know when it will relent. And I really use this kind of strategy in my work so that we can think through things with time. So they go for a long time and they hold us in a really intense way, a way that we can't look away because they're so extreme. While doing this, we're able to have a really sharp mirror to our own lives. The audience is not doing the performance themselves. They're able to project their own experiences, their own memories, their own meaning upon what that gesture is and what that means to them and how they've experienced it in their own lives. And that's where the real magic of the work happens. But the time that I use, it's like in our world of dopamine hits constantly, when I use durational performance, people can get into Einstein time, like relative time, and get lost in it. And in losing time, they're able to go a bit deeper in the work.
Artist Ida Sophia speaking with The Wire's Sam Giorgio. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. As always, thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show brought to you from Mamina Shakur at 4EB in Melbourne. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.